different for me. I've seen a lot more treatment work done here than in the past. And this has been a very fun session for me to be asked to do a discussant for, for a number of reasons. So the panel was very generous in giving me their slides beforehand, so I had a chance to prepare a bit of a PowerPoint and to think a little bit about this. And what I really want to do is to generate some discussion today about some interesting issues about where we need to go with this work, how we need to consider empirical versus theoretical considerations when identifying active ingredients. And I hope that we can continue to talk about these issues in the future, either during the conference, but also in new conferences. So you've probably gotten a sense that active ingredients are a part of a treatment package. When I've been doing treatment work for 28 years, and when we do treatment work where our outcomes are generalized characteristics, development, something that the child carries with them outside of the measurement context and certainly treatment, we often need a package. It's not a single technique that's going to do the job. And the package must causally affect the outcome. The ingredient must be affected by the package and then causally affect the outcome. And the package's impact on the outcome should become smaller when the ingredient is removed or reduced. These are the empirical ways we identify active ingredients. We can do this last part through statistical control. That's at least one way to do it. I'm going to talk a little bit about that in just a minute. Why do we look for active ingredients? Before I mention that, I want to separate an active ingredient from a mechanism. A mechanism is within the child's brain. An active ingredient is in the treatment. Okay? So an active ingredient is in the environment. It's part of the treatment package. A mechanism is in the child's brain. They're different. They both deal with mediation models, but they're different conceptual problems. Okay? So one reason that we do it is to try to understand what aspects of the environment affects adaptive change in people with ASD. And that's a really important goal. And that's clearly something that we want. Whether we want to use what I'm about to talk about to simplify the treatment package is still under reasonable debate. At least it is in my mind. So one way that we can use identifying non-active ingredients is to drop those non-active ingredients. I'm going to argue that that may or may not be a good idea, that you may want to think about that with regards to theory before you do it just on the basis of empirical data. And that's why I say maybe. So this is really fun, isn't it? I mean, identifying or attempting to identify active ingredients is fun because it's very challenging. We have to establish two causal relations. That's the effect of the package on the outcome and the effect of the package on the outcome through the active ingredient. And then we have to control for competing agreements. So there are several ingredients that are part of the recipe, part of the treatment package. And we have to control for those to find out, is this just about overlapping intercorrelation, or can we partition out some of this variance? And we do so all in the same model. That all in the same model is really important. In other words, it's not sufficient in the long run. I'm not saying that what's been done today, in different studies is not useful towards moving us towards what we need. It is useful. But eventually, in one model, in one study, in one group of kids, we need to have the treatment manipulation, the mediators, the outcome, the control for those mediators, and then the test of the indirect effect. So This is hard for me to see on my screen, but it looks better up there. I'm glad to see that. This is a multiple mediator model. It's a simple one. I've only got two ingredients here. I have... Whoops, that's not good, is it? I'm not going to use this. All right. So we have this random assignment to treatment and business as usual control as the X variable. Okay, that's what mediation models call the first causal variable. And notice I've put this in the context of a randomized control trial. And the reason I've done this is that ultimately we're going to want to look at generalized characteristics. We're going to want to know whether our package affects generalized characteristics or development. You remember how there was a lot of talk mentioned about that different ingredients are going to be salient for different outcomes? So we had some examples of ingredients being examined for outcomes that were measured within the treatment sessions. Those active ingredients are very likely to be different than those that are active ingredients for generalized characteristics. And then we had an example of where micro-interventions were used, where we saw, you know, very rapid changes in the child, even within a visit. Again, different ingredients for different kinds of outcomes. So I'm really talking about these highly generalized characteristics or generalized tendencies to behave. And in the context of that goal, you can see that these highly generalized characteristics are not likely to readily reverse. They're not likely to immediately change within a session. Okay, so that's why I'm talking about randomized control trial here. And then we have these active ingredients. We have at least two of them. And we're going to want to control for each of those because there's intercorrelation among them. So one way to read these kinds of diagrams is that when a box has multiple arrowheads going into it, that model means you've statistically controlled for the other arrows when you're looking at the statistical significance of a single arrow. So, for example, the B1, which goes from active ingredient A to outcome, if I'm testing that, I'm also controlling for the random assignment and for the active ingredient B. And I'm then testing that B1 path above and beyond these other parts of the model. Okay? The key point that this multiple mediation model does is it looks at the significance of the indirect effect. That's the A times the B path. So if I'm looking at whether the random assignment has an effect on the generalized characteristic, the outcome, through active ingredient B, then I'm asking whether A2, which is the unstandardized coefficient for that effect on of randomized assignment on active ingredient B, times the unstandardized coefficient of active ingredient B on the child outcome controlling for randomized assignment and for active ingredient A, has a confidence interval that does not include zero. It's not sufficient for this indirect effect, which is A times B, to be positive. We need to make sure that confidence interval does not include zero. If it does include zero, then we do not have a significant indirect effect, which means that we don't have evidence that we have an active ingredient identified. So we have an active ingredient identified when that indirect effect, A times B, has a confidence interval around it that does not include zero. Okay? This is what we need. That's eventually what we need. So when we talk about this, we talk about what we want to explain. In mediation model terms, that means we want to know why the treatment package affects this generalized characteristic. That's called the C path. The direct effect is the treatment package on the outcome controlling for the active ingredient. That's called the C prime path. And we want that to go lower or smaller when you control for the active ingredients. So when I was trying to help myself understand how I might explain why this mediation model works, a philosophy student in the audience said, well, why don't you think about it this way, Paul? Why don't you talk to people and say, well, what would happen if you didn't have the active ingredient? That's how philosophers think about how cause occurs. So the way we do that statistically is we statistically control for the active ingredient. And that's why C prime is supposed to be lower than C when you control for the active ingredient. And then I've just talked about how to test this indirect effect, which is the causal impact of the ingredient on the outcome. The causal effect of the package on the ingredient times the ingredient's association with the outcome, and then that confidence interval, not including zero. Okay. So this is a really important point. And when I try to make important points, I find it really helpful to move because it kind of wakes people up a little bit. So it's not sufficient to look at correlates of change when we're interested in active ingredients, because active ingredients of treatments are about causal impacts. So it's not really sufficient in the long run, good in the short run, to look at correlates of change. And that's mainly what we've been seeing today. The reason why is because if you think about what a randomized controlled trial does, is it partitions the variance in the change due to the treatment. And we do that by looking at between group differences. We don't look within a treated group. We don't look at the amount of change while treated and say that that is response to treatment. In fact, there was someone at the Autism Speaks Tyler Treatment Network who said a really important point, and that would be that it's helpful, at least from someone like me, not to hear responders and non-responders. I would like to hear changers or fast changers and slow changers, or fast changers and no changers, because change is not necessarily response to treatment, and no change can actually be a response to treatment. There are lots of disability groups that go down over time, and they don't go down as fast as the control group. And so they go down, it's often on standard scores, but they do go down, and they're still responding to the treatment. So anyway, this is my little plug for why it's really important for us to, in the long run, look towards keeping the treatment effect as part of what we're trying to explain, not just change. And notice in the slide, I've really focused on when the dependent variable is not reversible, or at least not readily reversible, and it's highly generalized. Okay. So I think that to know whether the ingredients are responsible, we must test the significance of this indirect effect, and I think that we must select one ingredient over others. In other words, the other ingredients have to be in the model too, otherwise we could very easily misinform ourselves because these ingredients are really overlapping, intercorrelated. They often are. So I recognize that not all panelists were claiming to identify active ingredients. I also recognize that all panelists were trying to assess the treatment effects, but we're really looking at correlates of change. And I'm really just saying this for the general audience. Amanda did a great job and came the closest to identifying the active ingredients, in my opinion. She showed that Jasper caused greater change in the putative active ingredients and joint engagement, albeit with the change agent, with the parent. And it's really important, and I hope you'll look at this joint attention in the classroom. That's going to be a really important thing to do. She also statistically controlled for other potential active ingredients, and I think that's a great thing to do. She could have, but didn't yet, look at the significance of the AB product, in other words, the indirect effect, and then examine the confidence interval around that AB product to see if the effect of the treatment package becomes lower when you statistically control for those active ingredients. I hope you'll do that. Brooke did a great job of telling us that there was a causal impact on of the treatment on the ingredients and on the outcome. She used the change data in a hierarchical linear model growth curve and partially supported that interactive play, really great example of some point I'm going to make in a second, and increasing the complexity of initiations through prompting were active ingredients. Really similar to something that Amanda found with imitation being a context-creating variable and environmental arrangement, which is a kind of prompt. Yeah, I see that. Thanks. I think Jenna did a great job of helping us understand the difference between components of fidelity of treatment. She showed that there was greater association of manual fidelity for reciprocal friendships, and that occurred very early in time. And then, Matt helped me realize that it's not just the active ingredient isn't just about the outcome being different, but actually could be for different people. And I really liked to look at the moderators as a way to look at that. Okay, this is my last point, and that's that before we drop our non-active ingredients, remember the way we've identified those non-active ingredients are through statistical control. We might want to really consider whether that's a wise thing to do. So let's take the idea of routines, interactive routines, predictable back and forth interactions. And let's say that wasn't an active ingredient as tested through our multiple mediation model, but that the prompting was. But let's also think about theory. So what if the prompting only works within the context of routines? And that could very well happen because routines make, they reduce the cognitive burden on the child. They make it easier for the child to participate, uptake the prompt, get access to their new knowledge, use the prompt, get the reinforcement, and then it kind of works. If we took away the routine, we might end up also diminishing the effectiveness of our prompts. So we don't want to get rid of theory. We've got to keep the theory in there. If you want to know a little bit more about mediation modeling, look at Hayes' text and then look at his free process add-on for SPSS. It's simple to use. Thank you. Can you stay up here?
Two or three minutes
for me? Question? Yes, over here.
That was great, Paul. I really appreciated your careful laying out of the statistical approaches to addressing causality and mediation. What can we do about the study design itself that would allow us to better assess causality, considering, say, like factorial designs or other strategies that might help us, so that we don't just have to rely kind of mediational models that are usually very underpowered?
I have a feeling I don't completely understand your question, and that's my fault, and I apologize for that. When you say, what do we do about designing studies to look at mediation, which is usually underpowered, and still keep the causality part of it, it seems like that the answer is one you've already given, which is to have big sample sizes. But I bet I didn't understand the question. Can you try one more time?
Well, I was wondering, like in engineering, there's reliance on multifactorial design, where you're a priori decisions about what the active mechanism could be.
Yeah.
And doing random assignments, sort of N minus one.
Okay. So, I'm still learning about these smart designs. You know, there was a symposium right in before here, and I thought there were some great ideas about using these multiple two randomization phases where you have a big randomization, then you don't, then you identify those that have slow changes, and then you have within the slow changers another randomization for both of the groups. I thought that was a great idea, and then secondary comparisons have to do with kind of adding components. That might be one. I'm sorry if I didn't quite get what you were looking for there. One more, maybe. Okay, well, let's open it up to the big discussion.
So, do you want to come up here, or are we done?
I think it's done.
I think we're done.
We can stand up here.
Yeah, we're done.